So today kicks off a lot of activities across the street with campus ministry going on. And if you're a new student here or an older student, we welcome you this morning. If you're parents of students and you're here with your kid this morning, thank you for doing that. I can remember one of the best things my parents did for me when I went to Western Kentucky. When I was a freshman, they stayed long enough and we went to church together at Greenwood Park. And they made sure that the right people knew who I was. And then I was there, and they expected them to see me there on Sundays, you know. And that was a real healthy move on their part. I don't know if how intentional that was, but it was brilliant because then if I didn't show up, folks knew, and they checked out on how I was doing and what was going on. I also remember that Sunday afternoon when we unloaded all the stuff in my dorm. I was just telling a family about this morning. Unloaded all the stuff in my dorm, and then they drove off, left me. I'm like, you don't do that. So I just sat on my bed and cried for a little while, and then decided I need to make the most of this, and had a great time, had a great 4 years at Western. Hey, this church family is very committed to college ministry and college students, and it has been for many years. It's why we're on this corner right across from the university. There have been people committed to reaching out and loving college students for 50 years around here or more. And we have, just to let you know how kind of invested we're in on this college ministry, there are probably, if best I can guess as I go through the directory, there are about 60 families that are impacted by our campus ministry in this church this morning. We have alumni of our campus ministry that came from other places, went to school here, decided, hey, I want to live here, and Southside needs to be my home. And so you're here, or maybe your kids went through this campus ministry and they've gone someplace else, but I mean, this is a church that's really been impacted by Cats for Christ for a long time. Like Barrett mentioned, most of our campus ministry folks are on campus this morning. Evan and Danielle Saxton lead our student ministry, and today, if you have time, I know you do because there's nothing planned on this time intentionally by the university, we're going to have some ice cream for you in this room right next door. You can come in the front door over here, walk across the lobby, and meet some other people. And then on Wednesday, Evan will start the First Encounter, which is the weekly event on campus, and it's in the new Student Center room 331. Is that right? Anybody know? 331, that's it. And it's at 8 o'clock. 331, 8 o'clock, Wednesday night in the Student Center. So I hope you can make that, but we're glad you're here this morning. Here's a line I want to throw out to you as we get into our message this morning. Where there's a will, there's a war. Just think about how many people have been hurt, how many families have been ripped apart, how much money have lawyers made off of inheritance wars, all because of greed. That's usually what a strike is about. You know, one side thinks the other side isn't sharing the wealth. The unions want more money and more job security and better working conditions. The management, they want more profit and more sales and more productivity and more market share. And seldom does anybody win. So we've been looking at Jesus' parables the past few weeks, and today we're in Luke 12, and you may have missed this. Right at the beginning of the parable is a line that kind of introduces the parable, and it's important to catch this part. It's in verse 13 of Luke 12. Someone in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." So this guy walks up to Jesus, and he wants Jesus to do something for him. He says, "You need to make my brother give me the money that belongs to me." And I just suspect the crowd perked up because they knew about this situation between these two brothers. It may have been a public feud, you know, out on the streets. And so it was familiar. You know, people were familiar with what was going on. When I lived in Houston a long time ago, there was a guy on one of the news stations who would expose entrepreneurs who had bad business practices. His name was Marvin Zindler. And if some merchant cheated you, you could kind of send a message to Marvin, and he would check out your story, and then he would take in the cameras if it was legit. He would take in the cameras and jump on the managers like white on rice, and it was a popular show. And I loved watching that at night after I came home from my job. In fact, it was one of the best parts of living in Houston. There are not a lot of reasons to live in Houston, I don't think, but that was a good one. And people would cheer him on. We would talk about it at work the next day, you know, and he would expose the scoundrels. And his segment was basically about embarrassing some dishonest business owner. And people love to see that happen. It had great ratings. So maybe the dynamics are similar in Luke 12. There's a big crowd. I mean, everybody's tuned in, and this guy thinks, I'll embarrass my brother in public, and we can bring in the cameras, and that should force some money out of him. And Jesus said, hold the phone a minute. I'm not a judge for brothers fighting over a will. And then he stabbed at the heart of the problem. He said, the problem is not that your brother isn't treating you fairly. Here's your problem. It's in verse 15. Watch out and be on your guard against all kinds of greed. This little tiff you're having with your brother is a symptom, but the disease is greed. And then Jesus adds, even if you get it, it won't make you happy, because the rest of that verse says, a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. You know, greed comes in all different kinds of packaging. We can be greedy for money, for power. We can be greedy for attention. We can be greedy for adventure and risk. We can be greedy for the best seats at the game, the best clothes at the party, the best jokes at the office. We're greedy for these things because we think possessing them will make us someone. And we may get caught up in a system which says, if you have a lot, you are a lot. And if you have little, you are little. And greed isn't only a first world issue. Greed shows up in some surprising places. There was a preacher named Stanley Shipp that I always enjoyed listening to. He used to travel around and talk to college students quite a bit when I was younger. And I remember Stanley telling a story to us about visiting Calcutta, India, which is, you know, one of the poorest spots on our planet. And he was there encouraging a few people who are dedicated to ministry, and he asked them, what's the most prevalent issue people in your churches are dealing with? And without hesitation, they all said greed. And this response came from a group that had so little they could call their own. So greed is not defined by what something cost. It's measured by what it cost you. You know, what are you willing to give up for a storehouse full of what you desire? Let's imagine that you're being held at gunpoint, and the question at the end of the barrel is, your money or your life? Your money or your life? We know how to answer that when a bad guy makes this demand of us, but we have a little more trouble figuring it out when God is asking us the same question. So now for the parable. This one's really pretty simple to understand, thankfully. Some parables are kind of a challenge to unravel. The one next week is giving me a few fits, so we'll work that out next week. But this one's not so much. A wealthy farmer in this parable had a great year, huge harvest, too much crops to put in his barns. You know, they just wouldn't hold them all, so he makes a decision about what to do. And in this parable, in his choice, we uncover a few lies which are still part of what bombard us daily. And it's funny to me how things don't seem to change. This is a long time ago Jesus told this parable. One lie I would like you to notice is this, that the farmer thought he could possess enough. And if you think about this lie for a few minutes, beneath this lie, we can collect enough to make ourselves happy are a few false assumptions. And here's the first one. He believed that the world revolved around him. In his eyes, he was the most important person in the world. This farmer lived in a one-room house full of mirrors. He looked north, he looked east, he looked south, he looked west, and he saw the same thing. He saw himself. Pay close attention to his statement in verse 17. Check this out. He thought to who? He thought to himself. And then, if you have your Bible open or your Bible app open, look, just kind of peruse down through there and look at the pronouns. This line is followed by these pronouns. He thought to himself, and then we have I, myself. We don't read any they's. There's nothing about them. No, these is just me. Just me, and that's all I'm concerned about. I read about an elementary school student who was asked to define the parts of speech, I and mine, and she said, I and mine are aggressive pronouns. And so there are a lot of aggression, you know, a lot of aggressive pronouns in this farmer's words. Another false assumption is this. He believed his happiness and well-being were the most important things in life. He thought he could get enough money to buy this happiness, and he really didn't know how much that would require, but these bigger barns would certainly help get him on his way. I'll say to myself, he says in this parable, you have plenty. Whatever plenty is, what's plenty for you? The famous Madame Blueberry of VeggieTales was asked, how much will make you happy? And she said, well, how much is there? It's a good question. So before we uncover the next slide, let's review what seems to matter most to this farmer in Jesus' parable. Not in any particular order, he seems to have settled in on a few things. Harvest larger crops, number one. Two, build bigger barns. Three, achieve financial security. Four, eat. Five, drink. Six, be merry. And seven, remember not to die. And that seems to be his game plan. That's how he hopes to live his life. And with this list of priorities, he expects to gain financial security, which is the second big lie in this parable. He says to himself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. I mean, how much? And for how many years? You guys have heard me talk about this. I come from a line of long livers. I mean, like 100 years old. Like, how do you know it's enough to fund a retirement till you live to be 100? You know, will the storehouse withstand inflation? Will it withstand a market collapse? What about healthcare costs? You know, when have you experienced a moment of full awareness that all your stuff is very temporary and ultimately useless? Here's a thought I ran across that's worth sharing. When we don't have enough, we wonder why. Why not wonder when we do? Mary and I had lunch with Sid and Betty Bain. They used to go to church here a while back. And we had lunch with them in January. They live in Panama City Beach, where the hurricane wiped out so many homes last November. And not a single neighbor on their street was unaffected. I mean, the damage was universal. It was indiscriminate. And around them, people lost their homes. They lost their family treasures. They lost their sense of safety. And so much of what these neighbors had accumulated was ruined or simply gone, and it happened, man, it happened so quickly. And Sid and Betty said after things settled down, the neighbors came together like never before. They had to do that to get through the day. And if any of them thought their home and their belongings were secure, man, they were deceived. And so are you and I. I'm amazed at the volume of space available in the mini storage business. If you're looking for a business to get into, this is probably a good one. It's a huge business, 2.3 billion square feet of storage in the United States. There's 7 square feet of storage available for every American. I'm probably about 7 square feet. You know, you got this much space in America for every person that lives here. Here's what's kind of amazing to me to watch. We leave $40,000 vehicles set outside exposed to the weather, because we have boxes of junk worth nearly nothing taking up our garage space, you know? And does all this stuff give us a sense of security? If so, we might need to think about building bigger barns. That would be the way to go. That would be the way to secure your future. We'll be covered for many years to come. We won't be a burden to anybody down the road. But you know, if our story ended here, we might be holding this wealthy farmer up as a role model, but nobody's story ends here. The comedian Stephen Wright said what this farmer was thinking. He said, I plan to live forever. So far, so good. This farmer didn't plan far enough ahead. He assumed his abundance of stuff assured him an abundance of time, but those two things have nothing to do with each other. Security is such a lie. Financial security, personal security, national security. We can do our best, but we'll never have absolute security outside of the security that we have in Jesus. Here's another lie you can hear in this parable, and it has to do with peace of mind. The wealthy farmer says, I will take life easy. He believes because of his stash of excess crops, he won't have any worries in the world. Maybe some of you have seen the new Lion King lately. Mary and I went to see that the other night. So this guy, you can just see him strolling through the jungle with Timon and Pumbaa singing Hakuna Matata. You know, I've got no worries, and there's nothing to sweat about. But we know too much. Peace of mind is really a mirage, isn't it? It's challenged with every downturn of the market. We just experienced that on August 25th. The largest loss on the market this year, 2.5%. Did anybody have their peace of mind challenged on that day, especially if you're about to retire? You know, it might have stung you a little bit more. Our peace of mind is annoyed with every request for money from a guy on a street corner. It becomes defensive with every threat of losing something that we see as valuable. It's critical upon the awareness of someone having more. During the economic collapse back in October of 2008, there was a Stamford, Connecticut man who lost $200,000 of his $500,000 nest egg. And he was arrested before he could pull off his plan to bring a gun to the bank and go on a shooting spree, as if shooting people at the bank would do anything to restore his loss. You know, I don't want losing my car or my home or my retirement account to ruin me. I don't want to be a person who loses themselves because I lost what I have been given in the first place. We throw out this phrase, net worth. You know, we talk about somebody's net worth like we equate a person's worth with the value of their portfolio. And I want to say this again because our culture tells us this. If we have a lot, we are a lot. And if we have little, we are little. If you believe you're the sum of all you own, then by all means, you should seek to own it all. Or maybe we should just discourage that kind of thinking altogether. Because the truth is, in God's economy, if my bank account is zero, my worth is still the same. I'm not ruined. God made me. Jesus died for me. God believes I'm worth the life of his son. And that's my net worth. A final lie I want you to see is that this farmer seemed to think that his money would provide him spiritual well-being. Verse 19, I will say to myself, or really it's I will say to my soul, eat, drink, and be merry. He's saying deep down, at the center of his being, I am fulfilled. Have you ever noticed how we associate success and career with spiritual well-being? Have you noticed how often when careers fall apart, we get angry with God? You know, have you ever done that? You don't get the promotion or the raise or the acceptance call, and we blame it on God. You know, being a Christ follower is not a guarantee for a quick climb up the corporate ladder. That promise is not in our Bibles. God never teaches in his word a direct correlation between financial success and spiritual well-being, nor the other way around. Wealthy people aren't necessarily in God's favor, and those in poverty aren't necessarily on God's hit list. We all know plenty of self-centered rich folks, as well as spirit-led poor folks. And if you want to see this for yourself, go hang out at the Embrace Church some Monday night. Talk to the people who are there eating a free meal, and it's most likely the best meal they'll have all week. And then don't stop there, but worship with them upstairs after they're finished eating and share communion with them. And you'll see it's a different experience in the very best of ways. From all the spring break trips I've taken college students on to inner cities across the country, God has taught me this. Poverty tends to open a person's heart up to spiritual truths, while wealth tends to shut the door to those same truths. Jesus said it this way. It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for the kingdom, for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. So this farmer Jesus introduces us to was looking at a mirage, and then came disaster. I mean, his end was tragic because of all the lies that he bought into all along the way. There's something about getting stuff that makes us want more. I had a friend in Vero Beach who used to say, the more you spend, the more you spend. This man's like that. He couldn't get enough, and even if he did, it wouldn't produce what he was after. Verse 20, but God said to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you, and then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? Now look at that question. Then who will get what you prepared for yourself? What's the answer to that question? Somebody else, isn't it? Someone else will get all that he has prepared for himself. In the end, all this stuff that we've stored in places in our garage and our house and our attic and all this, all the bank accounts, all this stuff will be distributed to other people, not because we're generous necessarily, but because we're dead. He's dead, and now his stuff goes to everybody else. Every single thing we claim to own in this world will one day be owned by someone else. Hey, I got a real practical suggestion that I'm going to throw in here. This is free of charge. Susan Bean and Gregory and I were talking out here last Sunday, and here's what we concluded. As we get older, we need to do our kids a favor and start getting rid of some of our stuff. We either need to give it away or toss it. It's not cool if our kids have to come behind us after we're gone with a dumpster in the driveway. If that happens, there's some failure along the way somewhere. That's not their job. Susan said, the older you get, the harder it is to do that. And though it may be hard, it's respectful and thoughtful. So everybody, raise your hand if you're, well, don't do that. Over the age of 50, I was going to say, but some of you don't want to do that. I'm like, I'm still 39. So everyone over the age of 50, we need to go home today and throw something away, okay? Or fill up the Kirby and take it out. Maybe your trash is tomorrow, which would be awesome timing. But that would be a great gift to your kids. It's like, I'm going to throw away your inheritance. It's perfect. Verse 21, that was free. Verse 21, so this is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich towards God. This guy's mistake wasn't that he planned. His mistake that his plans were that his plans didn't include God. And I think Jesus criticizes his arrogance here, not necessarily his affluence. I have a friend who wrote these words to me about this parable. I like this. In the parable, the man does not consider that the good crop produced by his ground was only partly due to his own action. He does not think about the favorable conditions necessary for a good crop, but only sees that they grew on his ground and believes that they are his to do whatever he chooses. He does not think about the weather, the soil, the temperature necessary to successfully grow the crop. He believes the crop belongs to him because it grew on his ground, even though much of the process was outside of his ability to influence or even manipulate. He chooses to believe only in himself. He chooses to trust his own abilities. He chooses ease and comfort and folly for the moment. So it really was about the farmer's arrogance, wasn't it? You know, believing these lies we've mentioned has nothing to do with the amount of wealth that you have or how much stuff you have. This is about where your heart is. This is about what you treasure. This is about who you treasure. The object of life, according to Jesus in this parable, is to be rich toward God. And when the knock sounds on our door, and don't forget, no one is an exception. The only thing that matters will be God's assessment of our lives. And he will be ultimately interested in where our treasure is, what we value most. He will be mostly ultimately interested in this. Are we rich in the economy of his kingdom? And everybody, every one of us is going to stand before him on level ground, the landlords and the day traders and the policemen and the social influencers and the pro athletes and the janitors and presidents and plumbers and ministers. The question is, what do you treasure? A while back, I asked a few people in this room this question. I emailed it to some folks. What does being rich toward God mean? And I want to close with their insights. Being rich toward God means knowing that the Lord offers me the opportunity to work alongside him and choosing joy in the work. Being rich toward God means holding possessions loosely, knowing they are given to be shared. Putting people before things and choosing relationships over comfort and ease. Being rich toward God means engaging our faith to receive the assurance of this overflowing goodness while we generously share our abundance with him. Being generous when it's easy and when it's not. Living intentionally with eternity in mind and with our eyes fixed on Christ. Being rich toward God means sharing our hospitality, compassion, friendship, and time with others, always from a humble heart, and with an attitude of thanksgiving for God's gracious gifts to us. Spending time with him so that he can remind me of his richness toward me. And I'd like to finish with these words. Shirley Smith wrote these, and I thought this was real, real insightful and precious. When we eat a bit of rich dessert, we close our eyes with a contented look on our face and say, oh, this is so good. We can only imagine that maybe God has this reaction as well when we generously share our riches with him. So what does being rich toward God mean to you? You know, here are four lies that we see in the parable. Number one, you can possess enough. Number two, having enough will provide financial security. Number three, having enough will provide a peace of mind. And number four, having enough will provide a spiritual well-being. Now think about it. Which of these lies is kind of tugging at you, kind of pulling you down a little bit? And what is God saying to you about what you treasure? I want to leave you here. I want you to leave here thinking about two things. One is your net worth, and two is God's treasure. And so I want to read a couple of verses that we read together, I think it was last week, and just listen to these very familiar words again from John chapter 3. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. So your net worth is equal to the life of God's Son, and you are God's treasure. Don't ever forget those two truths. Let's stand together and sing.